Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025, both adult and CYA categories. But we'll also be hearing from some other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $155,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories and the Reader's Choice Award. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading and writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. In September, Erin Brooks launched her new novel, The Extraordinary Florence Stoker, at the Peacock Theatre in the Salamanca Arts Centre in Hobart. She was joined by her publisher, Joe McKay.
Hi everyone, thanks so much for coming out and supporting local author, a fabulous local author at that. Before we begin, I have to comment on the gloriousness of both Oscar Wilde and Karen's outfit, which takes us straight back into 19th century Britain, I feel, and looks glorious, and that is of course where the book is set. I thought to take us into that world, Karen, you might want to begin by reading us the prologue, which sort of sets the scene for the book. You all right?
Yep. Okay, be prepared, everyone. Firstly, thank you for coming too. It's at least 20 pages, so I'm joking. It's a paragraph. Don't you hate it when authors do that? They start doing a reading and it goes on
20
and
minutes
on
later.
And on. Okay, all right. It's that big. Okay. All right. Prologue, London, 1927. They call me Mrs. Dracula now. Once more, I'm relegated to being the wife, this time to my husband's fictional creation. As I look back over the years, it's fair to say I've endured my share of monsters and unquiet spirits, all while striving to keep them at bay. Ever since I married Brahm on that chill December morn in Dublin, everything I've done has been in service to my marriage, to support my husband, his thankless labours for another, his dogged efforts to make a name for himself through his writing. Surely the choices I made, what I sacrificed, the secrets I kept, must be worth something too. If not, then what was it all for? This is why I must ensure Brahm's legacy, to prove that as his wife, his widow, my life also had meaning. It's all I want now, that and to forgive him, and perhaps in doing so, forgive myself.
One of those fabulous, enigmatic, hooky prologues that just makes you want to read the book immediately. It poses a lot of questions, of course, so let's see if we can answer a few of those in the time we have. We won't get through half of it, of course. if we go to the first chapter of the book, we meet the young Florence Stoker, then, as Tim said, Florence Balcombe, for the first time. She's 18 years old. She's 18, isn't she? Not 17. In 1876, where she believes she's about to become engaged to none other than Oscar Wilde. He's not there now, but he was. and we stay with young Florence right through to 1937 when she dies, spoiler alert. Florence is primarily known, of course, as we know, for being the wife of Bram Stoker, the creator of Dracula. And this is very much a biographical novel in that it gives us unprecedented insight into Florence Stoker's life and the two centuries. It covers centuries of great change, late 19th, early 20th century. But both the book and Florence offer so much more than just biography. It offers us insights into the psychology of the Victorian era, Gothic novels, the literary and artistic salons of the era, so much fun, is sexual politics and the fight for author copyright. It is a massively ambitious novel. I think I said that to you when I first read it, in terms of scope and depth. And so I want to ask you, Karen, what was it that made you take on all of that and write about this particular woman at this particular time?
If I'd thought about it for 5 minutes, I never would have done it, I can tell you. It was a much bigger thing than I realised. But what inspired me originally, it's quite a lovely story. A girlfriend of mine who happens to be in the audience, the lovely Lucy, there she is, her son Thomas, he was doing year 12 at the time and he had to write an essay on Dracula and we were chatting. And Lucy remembered that I used to lecture on Gothic literature and other stuff at university. And I said, oh, do you think Thomas, who was a bona fide genius, he didn't need my help. I said, do you think Thomas might like my lecture notes? And she said, yeah, that would be great. And Thomas said, yeah, I'd really love them. So, you know, you look over the notes to make sure there's no spelling errors and stuff like that. It was littered with them. But anyway, I repaired all those and fixed them. And as I was going through it, like when you lecture on literature at uni, you focus very much on the text. So I had very bare biographical detail about Bram. And I remember thinking, there must be a bit more to this guy than that. And because I love the book Dracula, I've always loved Dracula. But then I read his wife's name and I thought, why do I know nothing about his wife? I felt so ashamed that I knew nothing about Florence Stoker. So I quickly Googled her. And the first thing that came up was that she was engaged to Oscar Wilde. And I thought, another woman whose gaydar is way off. So I got really interested. And what I found was such bare information about her. It was like chasing breadcrumbs, except with every bit missing. I never would have got to the gingerbread cottage had I been Hansel and Gretel, you know. But what I found was really awful stuff about her. Do you want me to stop there? Just stop there. No, keep going.
Tell us.
People were saying that, I read Bram's biographies to start with, okay, to get a handle on him. And she's barely mentioned. And when she is, she's called frigid, cold, aloof, an indifferent mother, an indifferent housewife, a spendthrift. And I thought that made her more interesting to me, actually, in some ways. But I just thought, but they were married for over 30 years and so much happened. And then I started delving around the Stoker family and everything I found contradicted what these mainly male biographers said. And then I found a couple more modern biographies that did directly contradict the bit they had on Florence, directly contradicted it. So then I knew I had a story, a great story. Oh, and then I found out what she did after Bram died, that changed the rules for every single creative artist today. I thought, how do we not know this? So I had to tell it.
I mean, authors secretly like when there's not that much information because then you can make a lot of stuff up if you're a fiction novelist. So, but I think, you know, this has been a bit of a project of yours, Karen, in a way, is to write women's voices back into history. And I think one of the huge strengths of the books is that you do give Florence a voice. And, you know, while you portray, you know, the complexities and difficulties of her marriage very honestly, you know, I think that you also look at her and counter those things that were said about her. Many of your characters in previous books were movers and shakers and doers, brewer's tale, chocolate maker's wife, a weaver, a writer, a fisherwoman. They all often create. But Florence, you know, ostensibly doesn't. Or does she?
Yeah, that's interesting. And you're right. All my other lead female characters, I've been really interested in women's economic autonomy, how they made a living, you know, particularly in the past, because women did. They were always there and always earning and certainly supporting the men. But Florence is what, you know, and I don't mean to be derogatory or diminish her role, but she was just a housewife in many ways. She was a Victorian housewife. And, you know, here's her husband who got this job. I'm trying not to do spoilers, sorry, so I'm thinking ahead. So he got this job as the business manager. It was called acting manager, but it wasn't acting in a role, if you know what I mean. We think of it that way. He was actually the business manager at one of the biggest theatres in London. And she was by his side through a 27-year career there, plus the whole time he's trying to get his foot in the door and be a writer. All he ever dreamed about was being a writer. And yet he wrote, I think, in total 18 books. How many did you know him for? Yeah, me too. Just one. I read them all. They're
That's
pretty bad.
That's what she does.
I mean, they're adventure romances mainly, believe it or not. And there's two other that are slightly gothic, but Dracula is the one that's the key. Mm. So I imagine what it would be like to live with somebody who, as one biographer described it, lived a life of mediocrity and represented failure in the pursuit of dreams. That's how they describe Bram Stoker. It broke my heart. Mm, so sad. I don't even know if I answered your question, Jo. Sorry, I go rambling.
We're getting there. I think you and I were talking about her at one stage, and we were saying, you know, if she was alive now, she'd probably be an influencer. Because she created a world of connection for Bram, didn't she? She had these literary salons. And she created this sort of amazing set of connections. And she was just a lass from youngest of about seven from Dublin. Was she the youngest?
No, she was third
middle.
I wrote it so long ago.
Sorry. Basically, we both can't remember. Yeah, there was a lot of kids. And the family was quite poor, weren't they? And she needed to,
She needed to marry.
And he seemed like a good bet at the time.
He did. He was a civil servant in the Dublin Civil Service. And he threw away this... He'd been in it for 12, 13 years and, you know, had a great pension, great pay, and threw it all away to leave Dublin and go to London. And Florence thought all her dreams had come true because she had dreams to leave a fairly ordinary, dreary life in London too. And Bram, to her, encapsulated a lot of those. But sorry, now I remember the other question. So, yes, she didn't work in the sense that my other characters have, but she worked bloody hard behind the scenes. She was like a duck, you know, just gliding along the water and her legs are going 100 miles an hour underneath. So she sort of, set up these literary salons and brought really interesting people into Bram's sphere, all while tolerating what was going on in her marriage. And again, I don't want to do spoilers, but let me just say Bram Stoker is not who you think he is.
Yeah. I think there is... I mean, I think nearly all his biographers talk about this a little bit. They're described as having a passionless marriage. Mm-hmm. And they do question, don't they, what Bram's relationship with Henry Irving was. Can I talk about
that? Indeed,
is that
they do.
Enough? Yeah. I don't want to go too far, but he had a sort of quite slavish, he followed his every whim, didn't he?
Yeah, Henry Irving was the type of boss that demanded, you know, absolute devotion to the extent, say I'm here now and I'm Bram Stoker, there would be a courier running down here with a note from Henry Irving in the middle of this saying, can you exchange a £10 note for 2 £5-pounders? And seriously, and he'd send about 20 notes a day, no matter where Bram was, what he was doing, and asking him to do stuff that, you know, he had a valet, he had other servants at his beck and call, but he demanded... Bram's 100% attention and you know, it damaged the relationship with Florence, of course. And Henry was a complete narcissist. He didn't really give a shit. He just, demanded that of most people, but Bram allowed him to do it. Bram tended to form these relationships with others, men in particular, that were quite sycophantic. It's really interesting because you were saying again what drew me to Florence. Mm. Sorry, I'm going on a bit of diversion here.
No,
but she, I think it said on one of the slides, she inspired basically three of the, well, she was had relationships of varying sorts with three men who created three of the greatest literary villains of all time, Dracula, Dorian Gray and Svengali. And it was almost like Henry mesmerised, because Svengali's that evil mesmerist, mesmerised Brahm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you describe in the book basically, and this is on the record, I think, also as Henry draining the life out of Brahm. I wonder what that sounds like. you know, obviously the link there to Brahm writing Dracula and, you know, Florence's sense of all not being well in their marriage was there as well.
Oh, absolutely. All, yeah, right through it. She felt, again, it's so hard to talk about, but, you know, think about this. Oh, I should say Florence was considered the great beauty. She was so beautiful that people used to, when she was in the theatre in the audience, they'd stand on the chairs and point to her and look at her. And the Prime Minister, William Gladstone, called her one of the three most beautiful women he'd ever seen. And George de Maurier, who's the grandfather of Daphne de Maurier, said she was the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen. So she was this extraordinary beauty. And I've lost my train of thought again.
No,
I'm so sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I think...
I haven't even had a drink yet.
Yeah. No, I mean, I have, so there's an excuse to me. So, but I think what is interesting here is this: she is a beautiful, witty, amazing, talented human, but her relationship with her husband was problematic. And, you know, Brahm obviously was enthralled to Henry Irving and was enthralled to multiple men in his lifetime, including Walt Whitman, I think.
Yeah, this American poet who was very famous, or infamous, I should say, because he wrote poems that were quite obviously about homosexuality. And, of course, back then that was a crime and it was considered immoral and repugnant and all that sort of stuff. And his poems were banned in many places, but Brahm wrote love letters to him. And if you read them now, it's really interesting because it's almost like you'd write if you were on a dating app to describe yourself to someone. He described himself to Walt Whitman in that way. Wife to his soul, yeah.
So was this frightening for Florence, what was happening here?
Yeah, I think it unseated
her, Oscar,
it unnerved
Wilde.
Her. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, she watched Oscar, let's say, take a detour sexually. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah.
And be punished for it horribly, of course.
The story of Oscar Wilde, don't you? That's not a spoiler, how he ended up serving hard labour for 2 years in Holloway Prison, and it ruined him. It destroyed his mental health, his physical health. He never lived in England again after that, and he died in terrible pain, in terrible conditions in Paris. That breaks my heart.
So
broke hers too, actually. Yeah.
So within the book, one of the really fascinating things about the book is, you know, obviously it's a biography of a remarkable woman, but within the book we see a really strong thread of Gothic coming through. How would you define Gothic in that era, Victorian Gothic?
Yeah, I think the word uncanny is often used, or unheimlich is the German word, but it's that sense of the unseen, what lies beneath the surface. You know, I think of the Billy Joel song. Do you remember the Billy Joel song? It starts off, "We all have a face that we hide away forever and we take it out and show ourselves when everyone has gone." I think that's a bit Gothic-y too. You know, the masks we wear that people don't know who we really are underneath. That you know, the breath on the back of your neck that sets all your goosebumps and your hair standing on end. I think that's the Gothic too. So, but fundamentally, it's the unseen.
And of course, Florence had visions.
She did.
Of a monster.
Yeah, I made that up.
That haunted.
Yeah.
Did you? It wasn't real. No. So
it is fiction. Yeah.
And they sort of haunt her, don't they?
Yeah, because basically what happened, I won't do a spoiler, I'll just explain around it. Something happens in their life for real that is quite traumatic, and that I imagine, what would it be like if that happened in real life? Oh my God, that would be terrifying. And she's quite a sensitive woman in many ways. She was also bloody strong. But she, I imagine she would have nightmares about it and how those nightmares would translate. And particularly in an era where Freud was around and mesmerism, and they were getting consultations with crystal ball readers and, you know, all those quackery was around. So I just imagined how it would have been for her. And, of course, she lives with a writer who has this really macabre imagination. Brahm grew up on really quite ghastly ghost stories, you know, the Irish and Scottish, all the Celtic and Gaelic stories, which are really gory and wonderful. And he used to, like, one of his hobbies was to go and visit morgues. As you do, yeah. He was perfectly normal.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I started to imagine what that would have been like, and I thought I could see that would really haunt her quite literally. And then eventually she would talk to Brahm about it. And Brahm, like many writers, and there's a lot in here tonight, thank you for coming, and we're bowerbirds. So we look at you, we listen to you, and you might find yourself in books. And Brahm would often put the people he knew and replay conversations and places in his books. So I thought it would be natural that he would somehow borrow from the interesting things that Florence came up with. And she came up with lots of interesting things.
Yeah. And her vision of what this monster is changes throughout the book.
It does.
And at one point looks very like Henry Irving, who in turn looks very like Dracula. So yes. It's an interesting concept. Yes. I won't go any further in case I'm spoiling.
I'll just say that's not original, because lots of academics that have explored his life have felt that in some ways Dracula was based on Henry Irving. I'll leave you to decide. I couldn't quite make up my mind after delving deeper. I don't think it's that simple, but you can make up your own minds.
There's a lot of complexity here. I mean, it is a fascinating portrait of all that. I mean, and when Karen and I were talking about it, she was even saying, you know, I didn't even realise I did that. You know, some of the stuff with the Gothic visions and the, you know, all this sense of repressed sexuality and the fear of death. But it sort of came out anyway through just immersing herself in that world. And one of the wonderful things in the book is world creation. You really feel you're in 19th century London. You're rubbing shoulders with Oscar Wilde and Auntie Gabrielle Rossetti. And we see her exchanging banter with people, putting down that renowned painter, James Whistler, hanging out with Ellen Terry, who is a famous actress at the time, who is Henry Irving's main love. Yeah. What did you discover keeping company with them? What you know, was it difficult to recreate all these people?
Yeah, you don't feel you're up to it. I didn't think I deserved it all to be in their company. And you start to imagine how witty and amazing they would have been, and I just didn't feel up to the task. And it was really difficult, like, to recreate it and think about it. But I read their works, and that I got a sense of their voice. And they do start to come to you. I mean, I'd love to say I Ouija board stuff, you know, and they all spoke to me. They didn't. And I just hope if ever I ran into them, you know, in the afterlife, they don't, you know, knife me in the back or something like that. You know, they're all right with the voices I've given them and what I've had them saying. But it was fascinating and a challenge and great fun to do. And I miss them.
Miss. That's an interesting thing. Authors often say to me that they miss the characters when they've moved out of the world of that book. You know the feeling when you finish a book that you've really loved and there's this sort of like existential vacuum for a while you try and think, how will I ever live without this book? I think for authors it must be 100 times worse.
Yeah, I mean, my husband's up there, he'd tell you. I can be a bit of a nightmare to live with. Yeah, I don't speak in tongues or anything like that, but I do, I'm thinking about them all the time. Not in bed, Stephen, truly. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Moving briskly on. So this is probably one of the latest books you've written in historical sense. It's 19th century, early 20th century. So it's quite close to us compared to a lot of your others. Yeah. Do you think there's particular responsibilities and requirements of historical fiction writers when they're recreating an era where real people might still be alive or descendants of those people might still be alive? Do you find yourself more cautious with what you're saying or...?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. How are the lawyers at HarperCollins?
Pretty good.
Look, I think, and like there's a few historical fiction writers here tonight too, and you, Catherine, you'd know too, that I think when you, especially the close history, you approach it with such a deep respect for what you're doing, for the material, for the people, and with sensitivity and with empathy, and that's always at the forefront of your mind. But you're also telling a story and you want it to be entertaining and you want your readers to love it and keep turning the pages. So, yes, I was always aware of that, but I also knew it's fiction. so sue me. You know, no.
She didn't say that to me.
No. I did it with real respect and love. I really, really, this was such a wonderful book to write, and I love the people in it. I do. With all, they're fabulously flawed, and that makes them even more lovable.
You mention in your author notes, Karen's author notes are always excellent.
They're half the book, actually, so yeah. It's not that big.
Yeah. Our editor always goes, and another 5,000 words for the author. But they are fascinating, and none of us can ever cut them because they're brilliant. But we learn so much, all of us, from Karen. But you do mention that all authors, and this is a quote, I think, from Joseph O'Connor, the Irish writer Joseph O'Connor, in yes, Shadowlands. Yes. He wrote a book about Henry Irving and Ellen Terry and Bram. Yeah. And you say, all authors owe her a debt of gratitude. And that was obviously relating to Nosferatu.
Yeah, I'll just tell you quickly again because I cover it in the book. But basically after Bram died, this is just fantastic. I got really into this. There was 10 years after he died, a German film company called Prana Film stole Bram's Dracula and made a film which we now know was Nosferatu. And Florence got sent anonymously the poster of the film, and we know that fabulous image, you know, of Max Schreck, the actor that with the rat teeth and the big googly eyes as Nosferatu. And they even said, based on the book Dracula by Bram Stoker on the poster, but never paid for the rights or never asked permission. Now, there was a copyright law, and there had been one since 1714. It was the Statute of Anne. But nobody had really enforced it, and it only went for 7 years, and then it went for 14 years. So an author of anything had a right to be paid for their work. But she suddenly gets this, and no one asked for the right. She was struggling financially at this time because, of course, women, especially of her age, then didn't work. And fundamentally, she went into a huge battle for the rights, to be paid the rights. And she employed she got the services of the British Society of Authors, Composers and Playwrights, and they went through the courts for years and years and years. Long story short, hopefully it's not boring in the book, I do truncate it, but the upshot of it was that she had no choice but to ask for Nosferatu to be destroyed. Every copy in the world to be destroyed. And as a consequence, she's known today, particularly by film buffs, as the woman who tried to destroy a cinematic masterpiece.
Not very
that
popular.
Cow. Yeah. So, and yet, what she also did, because she won in the end, and she ensured that right now, every single creative artist, no matter who they are, what they produce, that enshrined in our contracts today is a copyright clause that protects us from theft by filmmakers, theatrical producers, television producers. And that's because of Florence Stoker. I've got goosebumps even thinking, I did not know that about her. How do we not know? So she wasn't a destroyer of Dracula. She was Dracula's champion. And it's because of her that we have the version of Dracula that's now filtered down in every which way.
So many versions.
Yeah, so many iterations. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. I mean, she's remarkable. She's extraordinary, in fact. that sounds familiar.
Good title for a book.
I know. I don't know why I didn't think of that. You did too.
That wasn't what the book was originally called.
Well, you can tell them what the book was originally called.
Yeah.
It's a very good title too.
Yeah, the book was originally called The Last Rights, R-I-G-H-T-S, of Florence Stoker. And marketing went, oh, people will think that it's...
She's dead.
Well, she is. But, yeah.
With
Ouija
book.
Boards and stuff yeah. like that. So yeah. then, yeah, Jo came up with the new title. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we did together, really. I always like to know what authors... Who authors miss the most of characters. You mentioned that you miss all those characters. So if you put aside Bram and Florence, obviously, and maybe Henry, who's such a massive character, such a domineering character in the book. Who do you really miss now?
Oscar and Florence's older sister, Phil. She plays a fairly important part in the book. I don't know if they did have the relationship I describe in real life, but she was close to
her sisters. It's a beautiful relationship.
Yeah, so I had to pick one because you didn't want to hear... endlessly about all her sisters. But yeah, Phil and Oscar are the two I miss. Philippa.
If you didn't know you were close to your sister, you would know by the end of this book.
My beautiful sister's here too, yeah, Jenny.
Okay, and I think I'm just keeping an eye on the time because I think we've been going a wee while. The other question that publishers really like to ask because it just makes everybody aware of it is, what are you working on now? What's your next book? How far into it are you?
Yeah. I have to tell a little story here. I actually was writing another book and it got accepted contractually and I decided to pull it. I said to Jo, I'm not ready to write this book now. Do you mind if I do something else? And she said, what are you thinking about? And I said to her, well, it's a dual time narrative and part of it's based on a true story that starts in Scotland and then I'm moving it 20 years later and it's based on a real thing that used to happen, and I'm going to bring the two narratives together. And the real thing that used to happen, you're going to love this, ladies, men, when they were sick of their wives, used to take them to the cattle market in Smithfield in London and other places and auction them off.
It was quite recent. Do you want to tell exactly when that was?
What? Oh, the last auction happened, I think, in Yorkshire in 1930-something.
Yeah.
I know. a gift from the writing gods. So it's partly a true story, and what happened to this particular woman who was accused of infanticide, I've then gone into the realms of fiction with thinking what happened to her after all that, and it's called The Auction Wife. That's the working title.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, but Joe, right. Joe accepts it on this and then says to me the other day, oh, the rights people need a synopsis. So I suddenly had to go back and write a synopsis. Yeah. Which is hard.
And I would also just like to say thank you on behalf of HQ HarperCollins to Fuller's and to the Peacock Theatre, to all of you for coming, and last but not least to Karen for doing it. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. Please remember to explore our extensive podcast archive where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company, Imagining the Past.